This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, the Fed decides, will it keep interest rates on hold for a second straight month? I'm Bob Moon in New York. I'll have that story.
And I'm Marcus Carlson in London, where we're asking whether Italy is becoming a soft touch for China's interests in Europe.
I'm Danielle Bokov in Toronto. The world's biggest oil exporters are gathering in Azerbaijan this weekend, and no surprise, the pressure from the U.S. is intense.
I'm Nathan Hager in Washington, where Congress has the week off and Democrats running for president are hitting the trail.
Four central banks in the APAC region will meet this week to chart rate policy. What are the key factors in their decision making? I'm Doug Krisner. We'll have that story coming up.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. We begin today's program with the Federal Reserve. Central bankers hold a policy decision-making meeting this week, and most expect the Fed to stay put for a second straight month. For more, let's bring in Bloomberg Chief U.S. Economist Carl Riccadonna and Bloomberg Economy Reporter Gina Smilek. Gina, what is the Fed going to do?
People don't think they're going to do very much. I think the real question is what they do with the dot plot. You know, we have been seeing a Fed that is still projecting rate increases. We get a new summary of economic projections, so both their economic projections throughout the year and also those dots that sort of signify their most likely rate paths. I think a lot of people are looking for some downward movement in that dot plot.
And Carl Riccadonna, has the Fed been signaling enough about what its plans are?
I think they have been certainly signaling enough and maybe even too much, because as we look at what the futures markets are pricing in, we can see about a one-third chance of the Fed cutting rates at the start of next year. I don't think that's where the Fed wants messaging at the moment. They're trying to signal patience, but a number of Fed officials have come out and really hinted that they're patient, but they probably are leaning towards the next move actually being a rate increase. That's not reflected in the markets at this time, and so if they're too heavy-handed on patience and a dovish message, they're only going to complicate this communications issue at some point further down the road if they actually do have to reshift market expectations towards additional tightening.
Gina, what do you think? Has the Fed tried to backpedal too much?
You know, I think it's an interesting question. I'm not 100% clear on what they actually want. I think this week will be really clarifying in that sense. And so, you know, maybe that they've over communicated with markets, but maybe this is where they want them. I'm not entirely clear on that at this point.
To be sure, they have definitely ratcheted back the rhetoric on inflation. They don't seem to see much upside risk at all, and for that reason, then that's why we're in this potentially lengthy holding pattern on interest rate policy. My own team's forecasts are that we will see an economy still growing above trend this year. Certainly 2019 is slower than 2018, but it's still going to be a year where we are above the natural growth rate for the economy. And when that occurs, you'll see the unemployment rate move lower and you'll see core inflation move higher. We've seen whiffs of that in the first part of this year, at least with respect to the unemployment rate. And our expectation is that we will indeed see firmer inflation pressures a little later on this year, and that will push the Fed eventually back into a tightening mode. But that's going to take a lot of work and a lot of movement in the markets to actually get them to come around to that view.
Gina, let me back up just a bit. Mr. Powell was on 60 Minutes about a week ago. And was that surprising to you, first of all, that he was on 60 Minutes?
I think it fits with his broader communication strategy, which has really been try and talk to as broad a public as you possibly can.
And Carl, what about you?
Well, often the Fed chair goes on in a moment of crisis when they need to better explain what's happening to mainstream America.
That was my question. What's the crisis here?
That wasn't what was happening here. I think this was just a good opportunity for Jay Powell to reinforce the message. It wasn't really explaining a change of course from policymakers.
I wondered if maybe he was going to address the President of the United States, but he certainly didn't seem to want to do that.
Well, that's one way to get his ear. I suppose, although they did have dinner together recently, but Jay was not interested in sharing any details of the conversation at that dinner. But I think the Fed is trying to really protect the sanctity of Fed independence here. And so by being transparent and really communicating why the Fed is doing what it's doing, maybe to some degree helps isolate it from concerns that there is some political pressure influencing their policy decisions.
Yes, but Gina, did we learn anything out of that interview that we needed to know going forward?
On the political question, he was very hesitant to talk about President Trump, but he did say that he doesn't think he can be fired from that role. We know the president was talking toward the end of last year, privately, Bloomberg reported, about potentially thinking about firing the Fed chair. And Powell was very clear that he'll serve out his term and he doesn't think he's got that the president has legal authority to get rid of him. He also, I think, answered a couple of questions in an interesting way, in the sense that he was asked what it would take for the Fed to either raise or cut rates, basically move rates in either direction again. And rather than insisting that the next move was a rate hike, he kind of sort of laid out some of the risks on his horizon, what he's looking at around global growth and what he's looking at around inflation. And I thought really walked a middle line, not saying whether that next move was going to be an increase or a cut. And so I found that kind of interesting as a Fed watcher.
Okay, our thanks to Bloomberg Chief U.S. Economist Carl Riccadonna and Bloomberg Economy Reporter Gina Smilek. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, speaking of presidential pressure as we were, OPEC and its allies meet amid pressure from President Donald Trump for lower oil prices. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Up later in our program, a look at the agenda in Washington. But first, OPEC and its allies meet to assess their oil production accord. The meeting comes amid pressure from President Donald Trump, who has called for lower prices. For more, let's turn things over to Bloomberg's Daniel Bokov in Toronto. Good day to you, Danielle.
Thanks, Bob. U.S. President Donald Trump has made it clear he is not happy with OPEC policy. The oil cartel and its partners have been cutting production to prop up prices. Bloomberg's Grant Smith joins me from London. Grant, it's nice to speak to you. So oil prices are off their recent lows, but they're not particularly high right now. So why is the U.S. president still pushing so hard on this?
That's true. Oil prices aren't especially high at the moment, but the production cuts being made by OPEC and its partners could push them higher. And that's frustrating for President Trump, both domestically and in terms of foreign policy. Trump is always in favor of low prices because he considers that to be a tax cut for the American economy. But in the foreign arena as well, high prices could be problematic for him as he implements sanctions to squeeze the oil exports of two major OPEC producers, Iran and Venezuela. And so high prices get in the way of that foreign policy objective.
So that gives us some context on the U.S. side. OPEC now meeting in Azerbaijan this weekend. How is that likely to play out?
This weekend, we'll see the biggest producers in the OPEC coalition get together to assess the state of the market. And what they'll see is that supply is growing faster than demand. U.S. shale oil is booming and the global economy is slowing. And so from their point of view, they'll probably consider it necessary to stick with the supply curbs, even though they've heard that the president wants them to relax that policy.
So that sounds like a standoff then. What's your sense of how much that U.S. pressure is going to test OPEC's resolve?
They could give way if the supply losses in Iran and Venezuela become so big that there's a risk of a shortage. Then it's likely Saudi Arabia would bow to Trump's wishes and increase production to prevent a price spike. But for the time being, the signals from Riyadh are that they are determined to stick with the production cuts that give them the kind of oil price that they need. The risk for them sticking with that policy, though, is that there is antitrust legislation moving forward in the U.S. Congress that could ultimately target them. The other risk is that the longer they keep prices high, the more U.S. shale oil comes out of the ground that they then have to deal with and cut production again.
Grant, thank you very much. That's what we're watching this week in Commodities in Toronto. I'm Danielle Bokov. Bob.
Thanks, Danielle. Now let's head to our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington to see what items in politics and government are set to top the agenda next week. For that, we bring in Daybreak anchor Nathan Hager. Nathan.
Well, Bob, this is a week off for members of Congress, and that could put more attention on the 2020 presidential race. The latest entrant into the Democratic field, Beto O'Rourke.
Over the coming days, I'm going to travel this country and listen to those who I seek to serve to understand from your perspective how we can best meet these challenges.
That was from his video announcement, and O'Rourke has wasted little time heading out onto the campaign trail. Bloomberg News Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gordon joins me now. We're off and running here, Craig.
Yeah, what are we up to? 15 Democratic candidates that want to take on Donald Trump. Yeah, with the big one still to go, Joe Biden, obviously the former vice president, former senator, still waiting to hear from him on whether he is planning to run. All signs certainly seem to be that he's going to throw his hat in the ring. We might not get that until sort of the first week in April, so a little bit of a waiting game there too. But yeah, I think this is essentially, you know, Biden in or out. We'll finalize the field or the ones that actually matter. And Democrats have a lot of folks to choose from. Everyone from, again, a former vice president, Bernie Sanders, pretty important former presidential candidate, Beto O'Rourke, the guy who almost knocked off Ted Cruz in the Senate race in Texas, and down the line. So no shortage of choices if you're a Democratic primary voter.
And no shortage of choices between the type of philosophy, I would imagine, that the Democratic Party has to choose from, pitting the progressive wing against the more centrist wing.
Yeah, and that's really the interesting thing that's playing out right now. A lot of the early candidates, like Elizabeth Warren, in particular, of course, Bernie Sanders, I would definitely put them a little bit more on the left side of the spectrum, even in the Democratic Party, with a lot of talk of Medicare for all. Bernie Sanders has championed free college, free child care, free health care. So that stuff's expensive. And a question Republicans are already asking, and it's a fair one, is sort of how are you going to pay for all of that? There are a lot of proposals for taxing the wealthiest Americans, the very super wealthy, and you've heard some pretty eye-popping numbers, like 70%, 60%. But you can only spend even $1 trillion. You can only spend it one time. You don't get to spend it three or four times. And so I think the question for a lot of the Democrats is going to be, how do you pay for some of these very appealing things to Democratic voters? And you've got someone like a Biden and to some extent a Beto O'Rourke who are trying to take, I would call, you know, they're still Democrats, so they're still on the liberal side of the spectrum, but a little more closer to the center. Beto O'Rourke today coming out saying, you know, Medicare for all would be just one possible idea for a way to do health care for everybody, but it's not the only one. So he, I think, is trying to stake out a little space to the right of some of the other candidates to be the quote-unquote reasonable Democrat in the race.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, these are issues that investors are going to be watching a lot as we head closer to the primaries and the caucuses. But I guess, you know, we're still so far away from that point that this field, this wide field of Democrats, has quite a bit of time, don't they, to sort of hash out what the details of some of these proposals are going to be?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the first primary caucus voting is February 2020 in Iowa, so almost a full year away. I do think voters are going to be looking for a certain amount of details. You know, it's very easy to go around and talk about some of these kind of highfalutin ideas, but people do want to know how you pay for it. That's where someone like Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar comes in. She too has been a little bit more skeptical of the Medicare for all idea, saying, look, who could argue with giving health care to all Americans? I just think it's really expensive. It's not the only way to do it, and we should think hard about, you know, a fiscally responsible way to do it. So there's a lot of flavors here and a lot of slices of Democratic politics, and voters are going to, you know, I think they have kind of a whole buffet in front of them of people to choose from. You're also just, it's just time to kind of kick the tires a little bit and see some of these folks do TV interviews, do some of the town halls that are televised, do some speeches and different appearances, and you get a sense of them as also as people and as candidates, and you know how they would sort of wear under a year or two long campaign.
Let the games begin. Thank you, Craig.
Sure thing.
That's Bloomberg Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gordon, and that is what's happening in the nation's capital. I'm Nathan Hager. Follow all the latest from Washington on Bloomberg Politics, Policy, Power, and Law. It airs weekdays at noon, Wall Street time, on Bloomberg Radio. Bob.
Thank you, Nathan. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, FedEx and Tiffany lead the earnings parade on Wall Street. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
I'm Bob Moon in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. Time to turn our attention to the stock market, and investors await earnings from FedEx, Nike, and Tiffany, to name a few. For more, we welcome Bloomberg Stocks reporter Sarah Poncik and Bloomberg Stock Market columnist Dave Wilson. Sarah, let's start with FedEx, the canary in the coal mine, so to speak.
Absolutely. And FedEx will be the first of the S&P names to really announce next week. That will be on Tuesday. And one we do have to remember, FedEx is undergoing a shakeup of its management just this last week. They named the new CEO for their FedEx Express unit, which is the largest unit for the company. So any direction there. But at the same time, when you think of FedEx, you also think about the macro picture. What is FedEx saying about the global economy? And especially right now, when things seem like they could be a bit shaky around the globe, it will be great to hear from FedEx's management what they are actually seeing.
Dave Wilson, what about the competition that FedEx is facing from Amazon?
Well, that's going to be a front and center kind of issue for investors as well, because increasingly Amazon is pushing aside the shipping companies, and not just FedEx, but also UPS and others. And, you know, they have their own cargo planes. They're as much as possible trying to handle their own shipments. And so it's something that you have to be concerned about, because it's really been an issue for demand for the delivery companies, you know, for several quarters. And so, you know, in terms of what the company has to say about itself, you know, it's not just the bigger picture, though. Clearly, you have to bring in the economic outlook and everything else to try and assess what demand for package deliveries looks like. But it's also just sort of the back and forth in terms of the competition. I mean, to what extent is Amazon taking away business by deciding to do it itself?
At this point, is Amazon really a threat?
Well, it is, in the sense that you're talking about such a big chunk of business, you know, in terms of, you know, how many packages they're sending here, there, and everywhere in response to demand from shoppers online. So, you know, to that extent, it is an issue. I mean, it's more like the bigger customer kind of taking the business away. I mean, it's not like they're going after other company shipments, at least not yet, though. Who knows down the line, because they already, as it stands, handle packages and so on in terms of warehousing them and going through with fulfillments.
Sarah, let's move on to Nike. How is Nike running these days?
How is Nike running? What a pun. So Nike reports on Thursday. If you look at their last earnings report, earnings came in strong, beating in North America, in China. It looks like their Just Do It campaign is doing well, even after all the hubbub and controversy that they did face last year over it. So we'll see if this momentum does continue, but this will also be an interesting quarter just to hear from management, because we have to remember not too long ago that Duke superstar basketball player Zion Williamson, he experienced a bit of a sneaker mishap in the middle of a game with his sole splitting, and that was a very high-profile event. And analysts do say this is more so just embarrassing. It shouldn't really materially affect Nike's numbers. However, that did just recently occur.
And Dave Wilson, we get a peek at luxury retail this coming week. On Friday, we hear from Tiffany.
Yeah, we do, and it's an interesting sort of contrast there. If you look at the top line, the bottom line, based on what analysts are saying, they're looking for, in their fiscal fourth quarter for Tiffany, you know, the fastest revenue growth in 3.5 years. And on the other hand, they still expect earnings to fall. So, I mean, currency issues hurt them because they do a lot of business in Asia. Really, I mean, it kind of sets up something that's worth watching because arguably now we're in sort of an earnings preseason for the first quarter. And, you know, you look at what analysts are expecting for the S&P 500 more broadly, you've got this anticipation of a 3% decline. We haven't seen earnings fall in a while. And you look at FedEx, you look at Nike, you look at Tiffany. For all three companies, analysts are anticipating lower profit for their latest quarter. So does that set up a pattern that we're going to see come April and May when we have a whole lot more results to go through? I mean, that's going to be something worth watching.
Dave, I can't let you get away without asking you about Boeing. Now that the cloud of uncertainty has somewhat lifted from that company and they're out of the direct spotlight, do we see that stock begin to maybe recover?
It's going to come down to, you know, how do things unfold with the investigation of the latest crash of that 737 MAX plane in Ethiopia, and what do its customers do in response? Because Boeing has $600 billion of orders for this plane, so there's a lot of room for business to get worse if airlines decide, well, maybe I don't really want to own this the way I did last year or the year before. You know, it may be a while before Boeing gets out from under the issues raised by this crash.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Stock Market columnist Dave Wilson and Bloomberg Stocks reporter Sarah Poncik. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, some key interest rate decisions on the docket in Asia in the week ahead. A preview next. I'm Bob Newell. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Earlier we told you about the Fed meeting and interest rate decision set for Wednesday. It's also a very busy week for policymakers in Asia. For more, let's turn things over to Daybreak Asia anchor Doug Krizner.
Bob, in the coming week, four central banks in Asia will be meeting to chart their interest rate policy. And all four, Thailand, the Philippines, Indonesia, and Taiwan, have been sounding a little more dovish lately. Now, you could say it's not surprising given the Fed's pause for its tightening cycle. But question is there more at work? For more, we're joined in Hong Kong by Bloomberg's chief Asia economics correspondent, Enda Curran. And it's always a pleasure. And I got to tell you, I'm torn between starting this discussion about the shift in the Fed's stance or the deepening slowdown in the Chinese economies as really being the key factors for these accommodating positions. But maybe these issues are different sides of the same coin. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's exactly right, Doug. I think if you remember where we were even just 6 months ago, these central banks in Asia were all in a hurry to raise borrowing costs because the global economic outlook was still pretty robust. The Fed was raising interest rates. The US-China trade war had yet to really have much of an impact. But here we are now, six months later, and all of the above have really turned around in the opposite direction. We're seeing signs of slower growth and factory production around the region, and that's really down to weakening global demand and as the China-US trade war starts to bite. And of course, we've had this big game changer on the Fed side of things with Chairman Jerome Powell signaling a pause. That, of course, takes pressure off emerging markets who also raise their own borrowing costs. So the net result is that we're in this position now whereby these central banks around Asia, which is the world's fastest growing region, are no longer under pressure to raise interest rates. At the very least, they're in a position where they can stand steady, if not cut outright if they need to.
So Thailand, the Philippines, Indonesia, and Taiwan, are they all pretty much in the same boat, or are there things right now that they're dealing with that differentiate them slightly?
Idiosyncratic issues, as always. I mean, the common denominator between these export-led economies would have to be the slowing trade story, the pressure on exports. You don't have to look past Taiwan to see the impact of how the cooling technology boom, slowing demand for handsets, and, of course, the China-US trade war is impacting. That's true of some of the others in the region, too. But it's not all about exports. Look at the Philippines. They had runaway inflation last year. This year, they are seeing prices actually subside a little bit. So that's giving the policymakers there room to breathe.
So given this dovish stance that we're talking about, I'm wondering about the potential risk to currencies for these countries.
There's always some element of that. We do know, of course, one of the reasons the central banks out here were raising borrowing costs last year was to support our currencies and make sure that foreign investors continue to park their capital in these countries. But nonetheless, I think it's a risk they would probably take this time around. If growth was slowing to the point where they felt they needed to cut borrowing costs, I think there's a sense of confidence that capital in the region has become a bit stickier. It won't necessarily be capital flight per se. They would have to be seeing much slower economic growth and cut interest rates to much lower levels before investors really turn around.
So China's economy, we know things there have been slowing. Last Friday, we marked 10 years since then-Fed Chair Ben Bernanke detected what he called green shoots of a recovery. That's as the financial markets began to normalize after the global financial crisis and the ensuing recession. Are we beginning to see any green shoots now in the Asia-Pac region?
There are certainly a camp of China economy watchers who will tell you there are green shoots. They point to the stabilization in retail sales that we've seen over January and February. They will point to a pickup in fixed asset investment, or at least a stabilization. The bears, of course, will point to data sets such as quite weak industrial production. I think the true story really is that we just don't know yet. Data at this stage of the year in China is always distorted by the Lunar New Year effect. January and February numbers are typically reported together. There is a view among economists that the stimulus coming down the pipe will start to impact activity from March onwards. So I think we'll have a clearer picture of where things stand around April time.
Basically, given the understanding that inflation across the region remains low, but I look at the crude oil price, I'm wondering about for the countries that are crude importers, whether they're going to begin to experience higher inflation in the near term.
It depends as well what currencies and exchange rates are doing, don't forget. It also depends what food prices are doing. Food prices are one of the biggest variables in emerging Asia. They have been somewhat subdued. You look at China, of course, and the factory gate side of things, they are flirting with deflation. I think that's an economy that will probably welcome something of a pickup on the commodity price side of things.
And always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time with us. Bloomberg's chief Asia economics correspondent, Enda Curran, joining us from Hong Kong. I'm Doug Krisner. You can catch us every weekday here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 6 a.m. in Hong Kong, 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thank you, Doug. We're turning to Europe now and asking if China's clout in the region is about to get a boost. Chinese President Xi Jinping travels to Italy amid concern that Rome might become a soft touch for Beijing's interests. Daybreak Europe anchor Marcus Carlson has more from London.
Bob, the trading relationship between Italy and China goes back a long time. Marco Polo wrote about his travels in the Far East during the 13th century. Perhaps it's only natural then that Italy might become the first major Western economy to sign up to China's controversial Belt and Road Initiative. But the prospect hasn't gone down well in the US and in other European capitals. For more, we can turn to Rosalind Matheson, Executive Editor for International Government. First, though, Alessandro Migliaccio, Bloomberg's Bureau Chief in Rome. Alessandra, there have been mixed messages whether Italy might become the first G7 nation to sign up to the Belt and Road.
Yes, that's right. I think the Italians initially thought this was a great idea. They were charmed by the idea, the Marco Polo, as you said, the Belt and Road ending in Venice, in Trieste, where traditionally where he left from. But they didn't quite realize that the symbolic nature would so disturb the Allies. They thought that actually this would be great. You know, you could sign up, make a gesture towards China, and then not worry too much about the content, at least from what we're hearing from our sources. But it was actually read as a very, very negative thing. And what's funny is, if you think about it, for example, Germany and France have much more trade with China than Italy.
Rosalind, let's turn to you for the context. Just remind us what the Belt and Road Initiative actually is and why China is staking so much on it.
Well, it's very, very big, at least on paper. It's basically, as Alessandra was saying, designed to link China's economy into Europe over the traditional overland trade route, but also a new maritime trade route. So it runs through Asia, Central Asia, Middle East, Europe, and it's basically funding infrastructure projects, primarily ports and so on, as a conduit for Chinese trade. The payoff for China is that it gets those links trade-wise, but also it gets influence influence in these countries along the way by lending them a lot of money and building big projects for them. So the strategic element is quite significant. It's really about embedding China in the global economy, but also increasing its strategic influence globally.
We've heard complaints then from the United States, from other European capitals. Is that just a case of sour grapes? What's the unease about?
Yeah, well, the reality is that many countries need Chinese money. China has a very long game. They're willing to let investments run for a very long time before asking for repayments of loans, for example. They tend, unlike other countries, not to tie those loans to requirements around rule of law and so on. So they will lend to countries, for example, that places like the US might be reluctant to do so. So the money is necessary. And in some ways, China's expansion as a rising economic power is quite natural. On the other hand, it does fan suspicion about what's coming behind it, because a lot of the state-owned enterprises are the ones doing the business in these countries. And the suspicion is, will there be a military imperative at some point, particularly with some of these ports, turning them into military bases? So there's a natural suspicion, I guess, around what would follow the money.
Alessandra, let's turn back to you. Is there a clear picture of what Italy might get in return for signing up? What's actually in it for Rome?
So initially, I mean, this government right now, it's a populist government. It's a project that they thought would differentiate them from other countries. Italy has a tradition historically of kind of cozying up the strange countries. And by that, I mean, during the Cold War, it traded with Russia at very strange times. It's been trading, it's traded with Iran. They do this sort of to differentiate themselves and to have different options. Of course, what's in it, obviously, is trade. They want to increase their trade with China. What emerged in the past few days is they don't want strategic sectors to be affected. So now there's an argument within the government, and it's creating more trouble for the coalition government, because some people are saying, well, okay, but not telecoms, not 5G, not defense. So that's what's going on right now in Italy. But as far as trade, yes, they were just hoping it would get a bit more trade and therefore more money in for the country.
Rosalind, if we look at the big picture, how strong is China and China's position in Europe? Is China's growing clout also coming at the expense of the United States? Is Washington's influence waning as a result?
Well, certainly the administration of Donald Trump perhaps has facilitated some openings for China. You've seen Xi Jinping come out on the global stage and proclaim China as the defender of the global rules-based order, right as Donald Trump is criticizing it. And of course, the US president has attacked allies and foes alike on the trade front. He's criticized countries like Germany and France and the UK, as well as China and Russia. So that's perhaps provided an opening for China as the US retrenches from foreign policy. We've seen Donald Trump talk about America first, which is pulling away from conflicts, from U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and Iran and Syria and other places. And that perhaps, again, is creating an opening for China to come in, particularly in Eastern Europe and other places on the fringe of Russia.
Yeah, what's interesting is that after this visit in Italy, Xi Jinping will also be heading off to France. And later on in April, he'll also be visiting Eastern Europe. Thanks so much, Rosalind Matheson, here in London. Thanks also to Alessandro Migliaccio, the Bureau Chief for Bloomberg in Rome. I'm Marcus Carlson in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thanks, Marcus. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.